Welcome everybody. I'm Stephen Blake. I'm a thought tamer. There's not many in the world because I made it up. I did used to call myself a thought coach, but I didn't like the coach bit. It sounds like I stand over you and go, you know, 10 more push-ups please. Whereas what I do is actually help people to sort their own thoughts out. And I show them how thoughts work, and that's what the talk's about. There's only room for about two or three, but I'm quite happy if two or three people want to come in. Thanks. Okay, I get easily distracted, as you can see, and I do follow a train of thought, because I haven't even got my notes out. Oh, I have my notes, just in case. But once I have a train of thought, if anybody interrupts me with a question or anything, I might just lose the plot. I mean, I don't mean lose the plot, but I might just lose the plot of where I'm going. And so if you can leave questions to the end, that's fine. If I look around the group and I'm telling you something and you all look puzzled, then I will explain it. Okay, but if there's just one or two of you, you can wait till the end and just ask your questions, okay? So what I do is incredibly complex, but also simple. Because although the brain is incredibly complex, and nobody really knows how it works, I mean, they'll tell you about neural pathways and electrical messages and synapses and chemicals and all that sort of thing, but nobody knows how we think and we form language and we hear it in the heads. And I mean, it's almost like a miracle, okay? But the way the mind works, it works in very simple ways. It works on processes, and it processes that information and puts it in there at different places. And what I've done is I've taken all the best bits from NLP, hypnotherapy and various other things, and I've looked for why does it work, not how, what steps do I need to do and what process do I need to follow that somebody else has told me. I've looked at all that and I've gone, well, why does that work? And from that, I've worked out, and so far I've got 13 of them, 13 different ways in which your mind works. And I do write blogs and things. And one of them is, I think it's 11 ways the mind works, because that was written a bit ago before I found the other two. And once you understand how your mind's processing something, it's not difficult then to see why you've got a problem. And once you see the problem, you can actually deal with it. And the majority of problems that I do deal with, typically it's lack of self-worth. That runs through everything. And I used to say it's 99.9% of the time. It's not. It's 100% of the time. Every single person I've dealt with, there's a lack of self-worth is in there. It's just that's what I'm looking for every time. And occasionally people come and see me and there's like, oh, I've got these five problems. And I go, but look at the thread running through it. And it's always lack of self-worth. And somebody gave me a very good analogy this morning, because I said, I don't actually repair symptoms. So if you get a boil on your arm and somebody comes and presses it and goes, look, it's gone now. A week later, it comes out here, doesn't it? And then you press it there and it comes out here. And then, you know, next thing you know, you've got bumps all over. So if you look at the symptoms, you might get temporary relief from it. And I'll show you some things today that will help you with temporary relief if you've got particular issues. So I'm always looking for the core of the problem. And the core of the problem, I know it's like a psychology thing, but it's always in your childhood. There's only one reason it's always in your childhood, is because as an adult, we can deal with things. So something happens, even if it's really traumatic. So say you get mugged in a car park as an adult, it's horrendous, but we then go, oh, well, it was late at night, it's a rough area, I won't go there again. There's all sorts of coping strategies of it not happening again. But as a child, something happens to us, and in that incredible moment of anxiety or pain or fear, we get overwhelmed with these chemicals in our body that just lock us up. And we don't know what's going on, and we don't know what it's called, we can't even name it. And then we feel this horrible feeling. And in that split second, you form a new program. Most of our programs come over a period of time. We learn how to do things. So you get up and you walk, you fall over and you fall over and you fall over. And at no point does your mother ever say, hey, don't do it anymore, that walking's not for you. Right? You just persevere until you do it. So most things in our life, we just keep practicing over and over again, and eventually we learn it. And for those of you who drive, when you get in the car the first time, and the instructor explains about the clutch and the accelerator and the gear lever, and you're doing all this and you're working it all out, and you've accelerated and all this, and he says, okay, put the clutch in, you put the clutch in, and then he goes, right, put it in gear, and you put it in gear, and then he goes, right, press the accelerator a little bit, not too much, and let the clutch up, but not too fast. And then you're doing all this, and they say, mirror, and you go, whoa, I'm doing the accelerator and the clutch. That's enough, thanks. Right? And you really struggle. And you can go down the road like this. And I bet you, anybody who can drive now, if I give you 20 quid to go in your car now and lurch down the road for a few minutes, you couldn't do it. Because you would press the clutch in or you'd let the clutch out and it would work. Because you can't override that system once you've trained it. So most things in life we learn along the way, and it's repetition, repetition, repetition. And so we also teach ourselves bad habits. So I used to drink a lot of wine. I've been through some tough stuff in my life. I actually give gratitude for all the rubbish in my life, because without it I wouldn't be such a good therapist. But I do this gratitude where I go, thank you for all the rubbish in my life, which I wouldn't be such a good therapist, but don't give me any more. I've got enough anecdotes, thank you. Okay. So we learn all these things by repetition, repetition. So even with the drinking that I did, it's like, if you try and stop, the unconscious, although you can give it lots of reasons like it's affecting my health or it's doing this or that, it's bad for me, you've just trained it for 30 years to do it. And it goes, are you sure you want to give this up? You quite like a drink, don't you? And so as you try to give it up, you're fighting your unconscious. And the difference between your conscious and your unconscious is your conscious holds 8 bits of data. Right? So if I read my phone number out to you 1 digit at a time, and I said, remember that, and I carried on talking, you'd either remember my phone number or you'd listen to me talk, but you can't do both. That's how little your conscious mind holds. Now, I refer to the unconscious as unconscious rather than subconscious, because there's things you're conscious of and things you're not conscious of, so I prefer to call it the unconscious. Subconscious means under. And this talk today will show you how incredible the unconscious is and how little teeny-weeny the conscious is. Right. Even though that's the thing we worry with and everything else. I'll get on to the voice in your head in a minute. So lots of things we learn by repetition, repetition, repetition. And then like with a habit, we're told that we need to do something entirely different for 21 days to wipe out this habit. Because over those 21 days you're going, well, I don't like wine, I like milk. Don't like wine, I like milk. And then you keep doing that. 21 days later, you go, I like milk. I've forgotten about the wine now. But if you can tap into your unconscious and get it on your side, you can give up just like that. And in fact, I decided to give up. And due to circumstances of being away at the York show, it's nearly a year since I gave up drink. I decided to give up, went to the York thing, went out for a meal with my partner. Went to a restaurant, she fancied a glass of wine. It was actually cheaper to get a bottle than 2 glasses, so I joined in, and then I was like, oh, I'll give up tomorrow night. The following night we went to a restaurant with no wine. Brilliant, but she fancied a glass of wine, so we went to the off-license, book of wine. I ended up drinking again. That night, my unconscious gave me a fantastic dream, and there was all sorts of symbols in there about not crossing a blue line. And if you think about blue line, wine, rhyming slang, there was tick marks, there was pain in the kidneys, there was so many different things that actually was a message from my unconscious saying, stop it. You want to stop it. I want you to stop it. You're not doing yourself any good. I stopped that day, Never had a drink since. And it's not that I now consciously go, I won't have a drink. I don't even think of having a drink. In fact, it's only because I remember that it was at York that I know how long ago it is. Because a few weeks ago, somebody said, how long since you gave up drinking? I said, I don't know. It just seems a long time. I don't think it's a year yet, but I didn't know. Right? Because if your unconscious tells you to do it, then you're more inclined to do it. Because it does everything on automatic. So you've got an automatic in there, and your conscious bit is your bit that you have the free will with. So you can decide to do things. So today when you said, oh, I think I'll go to that event, right? You didn't then have to keep saying, we'll now go to the car. Oh, I must remember to take the keys to the car. You didn't have to do any of that. Once you decided to come here, you drove here automatically. You might have had the thought, oh, I don't know where it is, I need to look it up on the map, as a conscious thought, but all the rest is triggered by your unconscious. Your unconscious does everything for you. Your conscious does so little, and yet we think we're clever because of a conscious bit. The bit we're aware of, we either think we're clever or we think we're stupid with it. But that's what it's there for. Occasionally you get this one-off learning experience, and this is usually a trauma. So if you do something that makes a trauma, the learning in that moment is, I don't want this to happen again. And in that moment, you'll design one of several things. The most commons are phobias, anxiety, or depression. And I've only just been working recently with people with depression. I've helped hundreds of people with anxiety. And however long they've had it, and I think 56 years is the most I've ever dealt with so far, it goes in one session. Gone. I joke not, as you'll see from my testimonials. Because all I do is I take them back to the original traumatic event and we deal with it. And when you deal with that event, this lack of self-worth goes. Because you don't have that program. So, I'm going to explain the difference between anxiety, depression and a phobia. They all start the same. Something bad happens. Right? Anxiety is, I never want this to happen again. You're terrified. I never want this to happen again. And so you have to make up, how do I avoid this again? So anxiety is, I'll keep looking out for it. I know something bad's going to happen. If I see it early next time, I'll avoid it. So that's anxiety. It's hypervigilance. That's all anxiety is. You're forever doing that. You might not be aware of that, but you just have that feeling all the time of something's not good here. And that might make you pessimistic. You might actually be quite optimistic, but it just overtakes you. Because it runs at automatic. It's not in your conscious mind, so you're not able to control it with your conscious. Because when we think of anything, it's like it's really happening. So something in the past that we regret, if we think about that thing in the past and we go, oh, that was horrible, we now have the same chemicals as when it happened. But we're bringing them to today. Because the brain doesn't know the difference between past, present and future. If we think it, we get those chemicals in our body. So if you think sad thoughts now, you'll find that you close in on yourself and you go, oh yeah, and it starts pumping those things around your body. And if you think of sad thoughts and you straighten up and put your shoulders back and head in there, you can't continue those sad thoughts. Because your body joins in with it and the chemicals are wrong and everything. Right? So you can literally get out of things just by changing your posture. Right, so anxiety is hypervigilance. You're looking around all the time. You don't know why you're doing it, but you just know something bad's going to happen. It's actually not a very effective thing. Because if you're forever looking for danger, what are you going to find?
Danger.
So you're not looking for good stuff, you're looking for danger all the time. And so because you only notice the danger, you then reinforce your feeling about yourself that you're not worthy. If you think everybody doesn't like you, you'll look for every time that somebody doesn't like you. And if somebody shows that they like you, you'll push them away. Or you'll go, oh, no, not me. And you won't let people give you compliments. And if you push people away often enough, they stop giving you compliments. Simple as that. And then you come complain then, you know, nobody gives me compliments anymore. Well, I'm not surprised. Okay, so that's anxiety. And I've only learnt this in the last 3 weeks about depression. I had two clients. One came with severe depression on the Sunday morning. And I fitted her in straight away because she was in quite a state. And she left very happy. She went from like a 1 or 2 of level of quality of life out of 10 and left with an 8. So she was skipping down my driveway. She went to work the following day and met up with a woman who was looking a bit depressed, gave her my card. The following day, the woman drove somewhere to commit suicide and pulled my card out and was talking to me on the phone. And I was going to book her in for the Thursday, and then every hair on my body stood up on end and went, "This woman will not be alive by Thursday." I just knew she was going to do it. And I fetched her in, and it literally saved her life. But she gave me 3 hours of hell of telling me how it couldn't possibly work, and no, it couldn't be better, and a life wasn't worth living anyway. I learnt so much from that woman in those 3 hours. I then did 4 hours worth of therapy on it, which I could have done in half an hour with anybody else who had let me in. It took me half an hour to make her close her eyes for hypnosis. And in the end, I had to say, "Close your eyes and your mouth," because she just kept butting in. The breakthrough came, and I'm quite unconventional, so the breakthrough came with her. I was trying everything I could think of. I actually swore at her. And she laughed. I was like, got there. Anyway, she left. But that night she went home to circumstances that were causing depression anyway. So she left, skipped down my drive. She must have hugged me 3 times on the way out, kissed me on the cheek, and actually told me that she loved me. Got home to all this stuff going on, and went straight back into the depression. I don't like failing. So I fetched her back in the next day, did some more work with her. She let me in a little bit more this time. And I suddenly realised the difference. When you go into depression, this is the program you're making up. So you get the initial trauma, and instead of the hypervigilance, you go, "Oh, I can't cope with this. I'm going to hide down this dark hole, right? And I'm going to remove all my emotions so it doesn't hurt." Okay, so you're in this dark hole, you're empty. You have no feelings about yourself, you have no feelings about other people. That's depression. That's as bad as it gets. But that's your safety place. So when you get depressed, it's about not coping with things. So the hypervigilance is you learn to find things and you learn the tools to cope with it. So when I take anxiety off somebody, it goes and it's gone for good. They have a week of feeling anxious that the anxiety might come back, but they would do, wouldn't they? And after a week, they realise it's not coming back. But with the depression, you take the depression off them. They get circumstances that they've never ever learned to deal with, and they go looking for the black hole to step into. And although depression comes on you without you even realising it, so you can be happy as a lark 1 minute and the next minute you're in depression, it's just that you're not consciously aware of what's triggered it. You are unconsciously aware of something. So something in the background has gone, "Oh, this trouble brewing up, I need to get out of it." And you go into your dark hole and you hide. And you peer out little bit by little bit until it's all blown over, and then you come back out again. So if I take depression off people, I actually then need to load them up with skills of how to deal with things. So that's the difference between those two. A phobia is when we learn something, but we learn the wrong thing. Because whatever somebody comes to me with, whether it's spiders or claustrophobia or whatever, that is never the problem, right? I had a woman with a rat phobia. She came along and told me that she'd got a garden that overlooked some stables, just moved there, and she'd always had this problem with rats. But she didn't tell me like that. Every time she said rats, she went, "Rats." Even though she talked normally for everything else. And so I dealt with this phobia on the basis that of what she told me, which was that she could remember coming downstairs one day with her mother. They'd gone in the kitchen and there was a mouse on the table eating some cheese or something, and the mum screamed and she screamed and was frightened. I dealt with it on that basis. I guarantee my work, so I always get feedback. So she came back a week later and said, I don't think it's gone. In fact, I think it's got worse. And I said, what's got worse? And she said, the rat problem. As clear as that. And I said, okay, we've been working on the wrong problem. What did you say it was again? She said, the rat problem. And I said, so you've got a problem with rats, have you? And she said, yes. And she looked as perfectly normal. And I said, no, you've not told me something. You've not told me something here. So tell me that story again about the kitchen. And she said, okay. So I went downstairs on my own and I opened the door and something ran past so fast I didn't know what it was. I called my mother and she came down and then we discovered this mouse on the table. And I went, oh, so you don't have a mouse or a rat problem. You have a problem with fast moving things that go in front of your face like that. And she nearly leapt out the chair. So I dealt with the actual problem then, rather than the one that she said she had. Okay. So phobias and all these are one-time learning. So let's talk about the voice in your head. And if you're thinking, what voice? That's the one. Okay. So is it you? Well, it certainly sounds like you, doesn't it? Okay. So, but does it ever tell you nice things? Yours tells you nice things. Lovely. How many more have we got here that your voice tells you nice things?
Occasionally.
Right. Okay. How many here it's like most of the time it's bad stuff? Yeah. Okay. Here's the good news for you. Here's the really good news for you. That voice in your head, not you. Not you. All right. Absolutely, no problem. Yeah, thank you. Okay, good. It's not you. It's something you've learned in the past that's been told to you. Or you've made it up for yourself. So when you look in the mirror and you go, I'm fat and ugly, and you keep repeating it often enough, eventually you believe it. And then you look in the mirror, and like people do with eating disorders, you'll get a young lass who's 5 stone, wet through, ribs sticking out, not an ounce of fat on them, and they'll think they're fat. Right? That is just a distortion of the facts. And the same about when we have a lack of self-worth. It's a distortion of the facts. In fact, most of the people that have a lack of, or a large lack of self-worth, are great with other people. They care about everybody else. But somehow they can't give that love and care to them. And sometimes it seems a very difficult thing to do. But once you can do it, you can keep doing it. But it's breaking through that first element of it. With a lot of people, I'll place them in front of mirrors and I'll say, just look in this mirror. In fact, I have one with shutters. So I just go, this picture on the wall is very representative of your life. None of you will fall for this if you come for a session, will you? And I open this up and there's a mirror there and the look of horror on their faces. You'd think they'd just seen an alien. It might be that they're looking and seeing me in it, but I don't know. But then I say, okay, just say I love you to yourself. Just say I love you. And I get this sort of like, I can't do it. And I go, well, just lie. You know, if you don't love yourself, just lie. Just say I love you. Like you know, throw away a line. Just say I love you. They won't do it. They can't do it. I had this with my partner who wants to lose weight but keeps sabotaging the start of the process to lose weight. Although she says she's very good at it once she gets going. And there's a little technique you can use where you ask 4 questions that ask similar things in similar ways. So I just wanted you to think about any problem issue that you've got. And I want you to think quite quickly, you're not going to get long over this, What will happen if you do change? What will happen if you don't change? What won't happen if you do change? And what won't happen if you do change? I said this to her, and this was about weight loss, and I said, what will happen if you don't change, if you don't lose weight? And she smiled. I said, what will happen if you do lose weight? And she went into a frown. So I said, you want to lose weight, but your unconscious doesn't. It's just told me. So the sabotage that's going on was something deep in her psyche that said, I'm not worthy of being slim or whatever. Or I don't want to look good because I'll get too much attention, or whatever that background is there. Or just, I'm not worthy. So from this, I said, well, just come with me to this mirror. And we stood there, and I said, just look in the mirror and just say, I love you. And she went into this mad panic. And I said, she said, I want to do it, I just can't. And I literally put her into a trance in the doorway and then sort of just gave her a few seconds to calm. And then she looked back and she said it. And now she can say it to herself. But you have to be able to do it that once to actually get it going. A few days ago, I had somebody who had a severe trauma at the age of 12, and I won't report what that was, but it was a really severe trauma, and she thought she might have brought it on herself. And I asked her to forgive herself. So this is her talking to a 12-year-old self, and she wouldn't even say it to herself. And when I got it, I was quite tough on her, and when I got her to say it, it went. The whole of the problem went. These words are just, they might seem trivial, but if they're trivial, why can't you say them? So they're not trivial. It's just that you don't feel that way. Just like you couldn't say, I love you to somebody you met in the street if you only just met them. But it's worse than that, because the person in the street you won't have judged, but you'll have judged yourself all your life with this internal dialogue that keeps going on and telling you things that are awful about you. I helped people with weight loss for 8 years, and I met lots of women, hundreds of women, who would go on diets and things, and the first time they'd ever see me, they'd come and tell me every fault they'd got on their body. It was, and strangely, the more attractive they were, the more they told me about all the defects. And I'd look at them and think, oh, what a beautiful woman. And she said, oh, but I've got terrible toenails. And my elbows are so wrinkly. And she'd show me them all. And I'd go, oh, yeah. And I'd say, look at this gut. You know, look at this gut. I had a woman a few weeks ago who said, I'm revolting. She said, I said, what's the problem? She said, well, I've got this huge stomach. She said, and she didn't. She had a little bit of a tummy. And she said, I'm 10-ton Tess. I said, I want you to stop using language like that. 10-ton Tess. She said, no, I am. I said, oh, come on, let's have the truth. You're not 10-ton Tess, are you? You're not 10 tons, are you? Yes, I am. So I said, okay, I'm going to give you a compliment now. Can I just say that you only look like you weigh 9 tons? And she looked disgusted at me. And I said, well, you started it. And bit by bit, I chipped away at this then because, well, it wasn't true. But everything that we believe ourselves that's bad is not true. It's simply not true. If it's harming you, it's not true. If you've ever done anything in your past that's harmed somebody else, that's a very rare thing anyway, and just let it go, because you're not still harming them, are you? You're harming you. And if you believe bad things about yourself, who's hurting you every day? So when I get the trauma of child abuse or whatever, and it's never the abuse. It's never the abuse. It's the way they felt about themselves. I had a 2-year-old who was thought they was responsible for having such a pretty dress on when they were raped, too. And she still held that belief, and she was about 50. She still held that belief. And I don't think she knew she held that belief until we got there. And she said, well, it was my fault. He told me I was wearing a pretty dress, and if I hadn't worn the pretty dress, he wouldn't have had to do it. So we believe all this rubbish about us. It's just not true. If you're here today, it's quite likely, because of the sort of event this is, that you are very kind and loving people. And I want you to have that love and kindness towards yourself. I'd like you to change your internal language so that when you catch yourself saying something horrible to you, I want you to think about you saying that to your best friend, writing it down on a note and taking it to your best friend and posting it through their letterbox, right, as though it's about them. Right? And if you can't do that, why are you doing it to you? Okay. I taught people a technique yesterday. Was anybody in my audience yesterday? A few, yes, thank you. If you don't mind, I'd like to do that again. Are you okay with me doing that again? This is about when we think negatively. This should be taught in every class at school. This is the most important thing you will ever hear in your life. The brain does not recognise negative statements. It misses out all the mustn'ts, shouldn'ts, couldn'ts, the whole lot. It misses them out. My best description, and the most amusing of this, is about chocolate biscuits. Okay? You sat on the settee one night and you think, ooh, I just fancy a chocolate biscuit. Now, I want you to all think about chocolate biscuits. If you don't like chocolate, just think of a biscuit. Okay. If you don't like biscuits, think about chocolate. But just get that taste on your mouth now. No, go on, just taste it. If I had a packet now, you'd all want one, wouldn't you? So as you just taste that, when you thought that thought that said, oh, I've got some chocolate biscuits in the cupboard, right? The mouth starts saliva straight away, and you've already got it into the mode of eating it. Now, your next thought is, oh, I mustn't eat the chocolate biscuits, right? Now, listen to that sentence. I mustn't eat the chocolate biscuits. Take the mustn't out. I eat chocolate biscuits, right? So you sit there and you go, no, I mustn't eat the chocolate biscuits. I mustn't eat the chocolate biscuits. I mustn't go in the kitchen and eat the chocolate biscuits. I don't know why I'm going to the kitchen because I'm not going to eat these chocolate biscuits. I don't know why I'm opening this cupboard because the chocolate biscuits are in. Oh, go on there. But I'll just have one. I won't eat the whole packet. And if you're not sick by the time you get to the bottom of them, you go, oh, at least I didn't start the second packet. And off you go. Because the brain is just hearing chocolate biscuits, chocolate biscuits, chocolate, and it knows you like them. Uh-huh. You cannot talk yourself out of something by thinking about the thing that you don't want to happen. It's impossible, impossible. A good tip for you, if you're driving and you get into a skid and you go, oh my God, I'm heading for a tree, and you go, tree, 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 you'll hit the tree. Right? If you go, where was I going with this car? Where would I still like to go? Down the road, right? So the tree's over there, and you go, I want to be down there. You turn the steering wheel automatically, and you go down the road that you were heading down. Remember that if you ever skid, okay? Because you will always end up where you think you're heading to. So if you program yourself with, this is what I don't want, don't be surprised when you get it. Okay, it's not even about law of attraction. You are focusing on something you don't want to happen. And as I said here, when you focus on something you don't want to happen, like the worry of the future, you step into that worry, you think of the worst possible thing that can happen, you bring all those thoughts and all those chemicals back to today. How crazy is that? I helped a guy who had cancer. He'd just been diagnosed with it, and he phoned me up and he said, I've got cancer, just been diagnosed, they won't know how bad it is for 9 months. And I said, well, I obviously don't help, I can't cure cancer, so what do you want? And he said, I just want to feel positive about it for the next 9 months. And I said, great, so what's your deepest fear? And he went, I'm not going there, which told me he did have one. Right? So it's always the double negative that I'm looking for. No, I don't want to go there. I've told you, I just want to feel positive about this. I said, but you need to tell me what you think's going to happen, and then we'll get on to the positives. And I had 5 minutes with him where he fought me until I kept needling him to get him angry. Because when you're angry, you fill up your 8 bits of data in your conscious brain. And when I got him angry, he blurted out something I can't say in front of your daughter. But it was along the lines of, I'm going to die a terrible, agonising death. And I, with comic timing, went, good that you've told me that. And then I changed the subject. He went from really angry to, I'm going to blow my top angry that I've just said good that he's going to die a terrible death, to, oh, he's talking about something else now. And he let me in. And I said to him, you are thinking now of the worst possible outcome in 9 months' time. Right? And whilst you think of that, that's probably what you think you're going to get. You aren't going to then do this thing of the worst possible terrible agonising death. And then they go, oh, actually, it's cleared now. And you're going to go, thank God I thought about the terrible agonising death for these last 9 months. Right? And even if they go, I'm sorry, but there's nothing we can do, you're still not going to go, thank God I thought about the terrible agonising death for 9 months. Because you've just ruined 9 months. So I said, well, let's think of other options then. Let's think of the best possible option. It's not your diagnosis. They've got mixed up with your name, right? You might not have it. It might be that you get through it and it's absolutely fine. You get the treatment and you're cured. You might, at the end of it, think, this is the best thing that ever happened to me because I've sorted out all my relationships and everything else. I've realised what matters in life to me. That might be an outcome. And then there's 1,000 in between. None of them are dying an agonising death. Right? So you want to focus on the 1 in 1,000 chance rather than, so focus on this one. You're going to get through it and it's going to be fine. Because it won't prepare you. Thinking in advance something's going to go horribly wrong doesn't prepare you for it going horribly wrong. Right? You don't go, ooh, wonderful, you know, great news. And of those of you who are worriers, I want you to think now, those of you that always worry, right? Just think now, I want you to think of any 3 times that a worry that you've been worried about has actually happened. Anybody got one? It doesn't work. You worry about the worst happening, and then when you get there, something else comes up that you worry about, and this one isn't going to happen now, so it drops into the background, and this new worry takes over, and you worry about something else. And nothing you've ever worried about ever happens. Okay? It doesn't prepare you for it. So when you hear this voice in your head, and can you all get that voice in your head, and get that nagging bit, I'm going to teach you a very simple technique. How are we doing for time, by the way, everybody?
22.
Brilliant. Okay. What I want you to do is, I'll have to tell you, then I'll have to show you. I want you to stick your tongue out, and then I want you to hold it. With your fingers. Okay. And now, try and think of that voice in your head. And this is quite weird, because the brain and the body are not separate in any way, shape or form. I get sick of hearing people saying, you're telling me I brought all this on me. I'd never say that. Your mind and your body work together. If you hold your tongue, you are literally holding your tongue. That's the saying, isn't it? I held my tongue. Oh, I wanted to say that, but I held my tongue. Whilst your tongue's not working, you can't have the voice in your head. Because you need your tongue to talk. It's logical, isn't it? Really? There's another trick if you don't... I mean, if you go in a job interview and you suddenly get voices in your head, you don't really want to be doing that. There's another technique where you can get the tip of your tongue and place it on the roof of your mouth very gently, like there's a little drop of oil held between the two things. And the very concentration of that stops this internal voice working. So that's a nice little technique. That doesn't cure you of it, but it does start to mean that you consciously become aware of this, and you're now saying, I'm going to take control. I'm not listening to you anymore. In fact, if you, when you get the voice in your head, if you go, that's just rubbish. You know, do I actually believe that? No. Because the other thing that ought to be taught in schools is that thoughts are not real. There's nothing real about a thought. In the here and now, things are real. Anything that just happened 2 minutes ago is now a memory. And it's a memory subject to distortion. Anything about, I think about the future, I'm just anticipating what might happen. It hasn't happened yet. So that's not real. So the only reality is here now, where we are. And if you have the thoughts that send you one way or the other, you're not living in the reality. You're living in this worries about the future or regrets of the past. And there's a simple technique for that. If there's something you want to leave behind, because we all have things we ought to let go of, don't we? So you won't be here today. What I want you to do is think of sometime, just imagining that you've got an elastic band tied to your wardrobe or wherever you are at the time, and thinking, right, this keeps holding me back. All this stuff that I'm dragging behind me and I've dragged behind me for years is holding me back. Now, you don't want to step forward and then cut it because you'll fall on your face, right? So just step back into it and just say, okay, it's gone slack now, and undo it or cut it and symbolically step forward. And just feel how you change. Just feel the difference, how lighter you feel and everything else. It's a wonderful feeling to let go of stuff. To me, dragging baggage around is a bit like every time you go on holiday, you pack a case, but you have to take every case that you've ever took on holiday with you as well. How crazy would that be? Stuff that doesn't fit you anymore, stuff that's not appropriate for the weather where you're going. But we do that. We take all this old rubbish. So the only thing you need to take forward with you is the learning from it. So when we get a repetitive thought in our head, there's usually a message in it that says, do something about this. Right? And sometimes it's just, I don't understand the rules associated with this problem. So let's take the end of a relationship, for instance. If we finish with somebody, we know all the reasons why we finish with them. Right? And we might not be happy, or we still might not be unsure that we did the right thing, but it's entirely different to if they finish with us. Because then there's lots of things go around your head. Was it me? Was it him? Her? Whatever it. Was it something I said? Something I did? How could I behave differently? Will I be doing that again? What do I look out for next time? You've got all these things posed. And I told you earlier that we either learn things by a series of lessons, or we learn things in an instant in a trauma. And we have to know the rules of it. Because everything that we run in our unconscious is run for us by our unconscious. And it looks for all the appropriate signs and signals and triggers and says, normally when this happens, I behave like this. And it does it for us. So if you've got something that keeps troubling you, what it's actually saying is, I don't have a program for that. It's not quite finished off. I don't understand it. And so, for instance, if you've got a thing when you're younger about, say, for instance, a father that you can't please. So you go into mummy and mummy just takes everything off you and goes, that's wonderful. Oh, is this a picture of an orange? And you go, no, it's you, mummy. Oh, lovely. And it goes on the fridge. Right? And you go to your dad and he's just come in from work and he brushes you off and goes, oh, give me 10 minutes. I've just got in. Right? And you don't learn that there are exceptions to the rule. Because you're a kid, you just don't understand that sometimes you just can't please people. But you've learned all these rules about, oh, I need to please people, and this is how I please people, because you do things and then people show that they're pleased. And then you go, oh, I understand that now. And you keep understanding it more and more. So if you ever find somebody you can't please, then what you do is you tend to fall out with them, and then you later in life get somebody very similar who becomes your partner, and you try and learn how to finish that rule off. Right? And you never do finish that rule off. And sometimes you just have to learn that some people you can't please. It's as simple as that. You put that last bit in place and you say, here's what I'm learning from this. I'm sorry, it's really warm in here, isn't it? So if you have a repetitive thought, you can do these techniques for not listening to it. I'll show you another quick one in a minute. Or you can simply say, if you've got the time, you can put it off and put it off and put it off. But if you've got the time and it keeps coming back, you actually say, what have I got to learn from this? And you think about it and you say, this is the last time I ever visit this. All right? So whatever conclusion I come to now, that's how we're going to store it. Right? And you look back at this thing and you make a decision on it. You say, no, it was him. He just couldn't keep it in his pants. And you move on. You don't repeat the same problem over and over again. Because that's what we do. We keep trying to learn from the same problem by behaving the same when we're in the same problem. You're never going to change it. And the strange thing is that people don't want to change, but they want the change. And you have to make that change. And sometimes you have to force yourself. And a quick anecdote of that, and what I learned from it. I went to a monastery in Scotland as part of my NLP training. And we did a meditation. And the guy rang a singing bowl, and I felt this vibration inside me. I'd never felt anything like it before, like a zigzag going through me. And I was like, wow. And this carried on for minutes. I mean, long after the sound had gone. And I'm now trying to work out whether I'm actually moving or whether it's happening internally. But it was moving so much I couldn't imagine it could possibly be happening internally. So then I moved my head. Bad mistake. The brain went, oh, you want to move to it? So now I'm doing this on a chair with 60 other people, hands on my knees, going like this. And so then I'm thinking, because I do what I do, I knew this was something releasing. I knew it wasn't something bad entering me or whatever. I knew I was letting go of something. And I'd worked with a couple of people a week before, and I made them look in a mirror, and I'd gone through a list of things to try and get the reaction from them. And each time I got to self-love, that's what they reacted on. So I'm going through this list and I'm going to the unconscious. Is that right? Is it that? No. Is it that? No. And I got to self-love, and then it nearly threw me off the chair. I have a nurse this side of me who's meditating with one eye shut and the other one on me, because I'm now in distress breathing and sounding pretty bad. She's expecting me to fall off the chair onto her, probably. My partner's this side, who knows enough to sort of stay there and just keep an observation of me. And so I'm now sort of shaking like crazy. And then when I got to self-love myself, it went, and now imagine, I've been doing this for 20 minutes now. This is quite a vigorous thing to do for 20 minutes. So I am absolutely shattered. And I'm sat there with my hands on my knees. And this guy then said, and we're going to complete this by giving yourself self-love. I thought, oh, whoopee. It's like within 10 seconds of me getting the answer, I was like, yes. So he says, we're going to take our hands off our knees now and just put them onto your heart. And just complete. And he's carrying on like this, and my hands are glued to my knees. Right? And it's like, ugh! And I'm going, what the hell's happening here? And it took me literally a minute to get my hands up in the air. And then I'm fighting to get them up here. But I'm shattered. I'm absolutely worn out. And I get them up to here, and as I got them there, it let me put them on my chest. And then I sobbed like a baby for about 5 minutes. I don't know what went, but I felt so serene afterwards. But it taught me a lot. And it's the fact that when you consciously want something, you have to win over the unconscious. You have to say, I want this so badly, I'm going to fight you until I get it. And your unconscious will then give in. It'll go, well, if you want it that badly, despite the fact that you've taught me not to do that, I'll let you have it. And that's what happened when my hands were up here. It went, oh, go on then, if you want it, you can have it. And that's just changed me around. I mean, I'd done a lot of work on myself, but this was a sort of final bit of getting to where I wanted to be. But it's such a big thing. You can't fight the unconscious with the conscious. You have to be in that trance-like state, or you have to talk to it in a way. But that's a session for another time. Okay, I've been Stephen Blake, and you've been absolutely wonderful. And I just need to tell you one last thing before you go. Inside the brochures and everything is a prize draw coupon. If you'd like to fill it in, I do have some pens and things out the front. If you fill it in, you get 50% off a session with me or a CD about a resource of your choice. If you don't want that session and you win it, you can give it to a friend. I'm quite happy to treat anybody with this. Okay? Please take as many leaflets and cards as you like, because as I say, the other day, a card literally saved somebody's life. And to end on a final note, the woman who didn't kill herself, a week later, was walking through town, spotted a woman absent-mindedly stepping out in the road, pulled her out of the way of an oncoming car, saved her life. And she wrote to me and told me this, and I said, a week ago you didn't value your life. You've just saved two families going through bereavement. Thank you. Thank you.